Hi, and welcome to episode 58 of the Fresh Out of Tokens podcast with Tanya, also known as Cypher Tier, and my co-host David. If you want to say hello, David.
Hello. How is your weekend?
It was busy, and it's hot as hell in Chicago, so, you know, I apologize to listeners for last week's episode. If you heard an ongoing hum because it is too hot to not have air conditioning or a fan on. And I'm very, very, very happy to have not just a really awesome person on the show, but one of my dear friends and someone I'm very glad to bring on to talk about a variety of things, not just gaming. Please welcome Michi Trotta, also known as Geek Melange.
Hi, everybody. Oh, Tanya, that's so flattering. It makes me feel warm and fuzzy inside.
Yay. Well, you also feed me treats and ube donuts, so...
Oh, yes. I sadly was not able to get you ube donuts this last weekend, but I swear, when they come around again, I will totally make sure I get you one, because they were incredible.
Well, you
they did not last the whole weekend.
I'm surprised they lasted the trip home.
There were a dozen I had to control myself on the train.
Yes, we will get into food nerdery after this brief introduction, and we will get into our questions for you from ourselves and from our listeners.
Awesome.
So for those folks listening either for the first time or from the first episode, this is Fresh Out of Tokens, where we have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games Spreadshirt shop, where we split the profits at 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bobinks, and we also have a blog to complement the show, where you can follow us over at outoftokenscast.com. If you have questions, compliments, would like to be a guest, or have feedback on an episode, drop us a line at freshoutoftokens@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter, which is @outoftokenscast. Musical accompaniment for Fresh Out of Tokens is provided by Mike Moody. You can hear more of her work at soundcloud.com/MikeMoody-1. And with our usual spiel out of the way, Michi, I am very happy and honored to know who you are and what you do. But for those folks listening, can you give us a bit of background?
So I guess I like to call myself a geek of all, geek of many trades. I am the managing editor for the now Hugo Award and World Fantasy Award finalist publication, Uncanny, a magazine of science fiction and fantasy. That actually makes me the first Filipina to ever be nominated for a Hugo Award, which is, you know, really incredible. I am also a board member for the Chicago Nerd Social Club. I am a blogger and essayist. I have a blog at geekmelange.com where I will often write about fandom and geek culture, often about issues of inclusiveness, diversity, representation, but also things that I just like, because particularly things like 80s cartoons and movie soundtracks, and I stand really hard for Leverage and Person of Interest, two of my favorite shows. And I will occasionally have food recipes, because food geekery is a big part of who I am. And when I have spare time, and very, very rare of it, but I will be spinning fire, often in cosplay. I'm part of the Rax Geek Fire and Belly Dance Performance Troupe in Chicago. We actually have a gig coming up this Friday and Saturday. Saturday is going to be the first time we're doing an afternoon matinee family-friendly show, which I'm really excited to do. And I do a lot of panels and community organizing here in Chicago, particularly through Chicago Nerd Social Club. So that is a little bit about what I do.
So do you sleep?
Yes, not as much as I'd like. Sleep and I are like two ships passing in the night where we're reaching out and can't quite manage to grasp each other. coffee and sugar and I are very, very good friends. Also, I just kind of keep myself going out of sheer stubborn spite half the time. I do eventually pay for it. And that's usually when my husband comes in, just kind of gives me this look, comes back in with, goes into the kitchen and comes back with a tray and a giant mug of tea and just puts it in front of me and is like, "You did this to yourself." I'm like, "Yes, I know." Every time.
Well, I think the going out of sheer spite is why we're such good friends.
Ah, yes. Well, you know, we can smell our own. There's like a little secret tribe of us where we're like, we look around, we're like, yup, one of us.
Oh my god.
One of your most endearing qualities, Tanya. It's why I like you so much.
I am a spiteful asshole. People just don't realize it.
Well, you know, that's because you don't bring it out unless you have to. I mean, it is a weapon that is not wielded lightly, but when it is, I just kind of sit back and with a bag of popcorn and just sort of sit there laughing to myself watching you go, because it is a thing of beauty to behold.
My God.
You do the same thing to me too, you know.
Oh, I do. I'm just, it's one of the things where I'm just going to giggle about it forever, so.
So, I don't have a good transition there. So you're not a gamer, but you did mention that, you know, you're a geek. So what made you really realize your geeky ways?
I don't know if I ever actually had a realization that I was a geek, because that was just life. For me, both my parents were massive nerds. My mom was a really big, more like epic fantasy, Tolkien, fairy tales. Both of my parents were big history buffs. My dad was a little bit more hard sci-fi, and a lot of 80s cartoons, particularly, you know, at the time I was growing up, there was a lot of adapted anime on the TV, so we watched things like Robotech and Captain Harlock and Star Blazers, and I just sort of grew up in it. Nothing about it seemed out of the ordinary, and it was actually weird to me when I would meet people and they didn't know what this stuff was. So gaming is just one of those things that I never managed to get into, partly because it does it's a lot of time and investment. Particularly, most of the people I knew when I was growing up were like RPGers, Dungeons and Dragons and Magic the Gathering, and a lot of those things. Like, you're clearly putting a lot of time and energy to this, and that's great, but I only have so much time and energy of my own. Also, wow, the money that I had that my friends would plunk down on Magic cards, and I mean, like, Magic back in the 90s, just ridiculous. And to be fair, when I was also growing up, most of the places that I could play video games were arcades. And if you were a girl who walked into an arcade, and you were not really like a good player, I was a casual player for things like Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter. And I just never, like, playing just never was enjoyable because it was super competitive. There were people who would try to just blow you out of the water as quickly as possible. It was all about showing off. So I ended up becoming a pinball player instead of a video gamer, because that's what my experience was like walking into arcades. And the people I knew who had gaming systems, it was sort of the same thing. I don't think my dude friends realized that that's what they were doing, but it made playing video games not a really pleasant experience. So if you couple that with the fact that I hate losing at anything, that just sort of pushed gaming down the ladder in terms of things that I was going to be spending time and money on.
Okay. But speaking of things you spend time and money on, and among the million things that you do fire spinning. And I've got a chance to see you do fire spinning and, you know, kind of teach people the basics of it. You know, it's not a common pastime. So I was wondering, you know, of all the things you do, how did that happen?
That's totally the fault of my friend Sasha. I met her in college when we were both living in Boston, and she had grown up in South Africa, and apparently she had started spinning fire poi when she was a teenager, and I would see her spinning poi that was not on fire. She had practice poi that had ribbons on it, so you get those really nice trails, because Poi are based off of a tool that's used by the Maori in New Zealand, and it has become a really big part of burner culture in the US. And just in a really sort of like roundabout way, I ended up sort of picking up one of Sasha's old practice sets, and I played with it for about 6 or 7 years before I moved to Chicago, and then just randomly through a reconnecting with a friend that I hadn't seen in something like 10 or 15 years, realized that Chicago had a huge fire performance and circus arts performance community.
Are you okay?
And got hooked into that and managed to learn about fire spinning in a safe and cooperative environment where they were actually teaching me the proper gear to get, what kind of fuel, how to choose my tools, and it was a way that I could get into doing it knowing that I was doing it safely instead of picking up bad habits. So it has been an amazing part of my life. I can't believe that this is something that I get to do, and I love sharing it with other people because it is a way that has been really good for me to actually get comfortable with my body and how I move. I'm sort of built like a tank. Whenever I would play football with my friends, I was usually like, you know, linebacker type. I've got big shoulders. I get very muscly when I work out. And doing fire spinning was actually a way for me to feel like I was actually graceful, not just powerful, but powerful and graceful, and they weren't mutually exclusive things. And it was a way for me to actually learn how to express myself physically through movement and through dance, and in a way that is, fire spinning has that allure of danger, but as long as you are doing it safely, you're doing it responsibly, it's not really a super dangerous kind of thing. You just have to respect your tools, you respect your performers, you respect the medium that you are using, and it is a wonderful way to keep yourself fit, to feel like you're moving. If I don't practice for a lot, I used to practice 4 or 5 days a week when I had the time, and now, you know, with everything else I do and working a full-time job, I don't get as much time, and I can definitely tell I'm a little stiffer. I'm also getting older, so that's not helping. But this is a really great way to do something physical that keeps me from, you know, spending all my time sitting in front of the computer. And I get to merge it with a lot of my nerdy passions, because when you can, if you put together cosplay that is fire safe, you know, you use natural fiber materials like leather, cotton, denim, you do it safely, you can actually come up with these really cool characters that are just enhanced by using fire. Or if I can't do fire, I have tools that have LED lights in them that are black light reflective. And that just look, some of them are made out of really colorful, shiny materials that I can just play with them in the sunlight and they look fantastic.
Hmm. That is fascinating.
It's a lot of fun. It is super fun. It's also a really good way for me to get in my cardio, which I actually hate. I used to run. I don't run anymore. So it's something that keeps that I can actually like feel like I'm being active without feeling like I'm actually going through the drudgery of working out is a really, really good thing.
Yeah, I think that's that sentence is the exact appeal of Pokemon Go.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people are like they're sort of stunned by how much they're walking just by playing. I had a friend who was like, in the span of I think 5 days, he clocked something like 19 miles.
I believe that.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. He was playing with his kids too, so there was a lot of running around, and you know, it's turned into sort of like a really cool family thing for them to all do together, where they're playing a game and they're like walking around outside and they're getting around their neighborhood, they're going to like the parks and everything. It sounds super cool.
Yeah, and we will definitely discuss that later on, but right now we I wanted to ask. So you're the editor for Uncanny Magazine, which is an amazing publication, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Which you were, which was nominated for a Hugo and a World Fantasy Award this year, and that is just incredible. What was your like? How did you get from being like a person who reads sci-fi to, you know, being the managing editor of a magazine?
Well, I kind of really like this story because it's sort of a great example for one of the things that I really love and think that is really important about creating a healthy community in science fiction and fantasy. So I've been a fan for most of my life, but I have not always felt like I was a part of fandom. You know, I'm an Asian American, specifically I'm a Filipino woman. Most of the spaces that I had been to in fandom in, you know, different areas of geek culture felt very white dominated. A lot of the you know, characters and stories that I loved were still treating people like me as either side characters or I couldn't even find myself at all. There were very few characters who I could relate to because they spoke specifically to my experience as an Asian American Pacific Islander. And what it was like, I started getting involved in fandom a couple of years ago because I just had gone to a convention and I sort of got fed up with the way that panels were being run. Some of the discussions just were not getting into the things that I really wanted to hear people talk about. So I started getting involved in more panels and more conventions. And I had been laboring under the misconception that you had to be like a name in order to submit panels to things like Wizard World or C2E2. And shockingly, I was like, wait, you mean you can just be a fan and have really and have passionate things to say? And as long as you put together a proposal that reads well, and you can get really cool people to be involved and talk with you on this panel, you can do this sort of thing. That's sort of great. So I've been involved a little bit with with conventions as panelists. I got involved with Chicago Nerds as one of the board of organizers, and that brought me into contact with Uncanny's editors-in-chief, Lynn and Michael Thomas, who I had known of because of their work editing Apex magazine and as editors for the Chicks Dig Time Lords, Queers Dig Time Lords, those series of books that were essay collections that I absolutely, absolutely loved. And through some mutual friends, we managed to start circling each other's orbit and getting to know each other by being on a couple of panels together at conventions. And in the meantime, my full-time job had been as a managing editor for an association publication. I've actually been working in publishing in editorial capacities for almost 20 years now. And as I got to know them, you know, I guess they decided that they were going to take a chance and asked me to be Uncanny's managing editor when they decided to start the project in 2014. I mean, you could have blown me over with, you know, just like a little puff of breath when I opened the email and was like, I sort of stared at it for a while. I was at a convention. I had just woken up. You know, I'm checking my email in the morning. I haven't even had my coffee. And I just sort of look at it and I'm like, wait, they're asking me to do what now? Because I felt like, who the hell am I? I've hung out with them. I knew them socially. I really liked them as people. And they knew that I had a professional background. But I was like, do I really... And this is where imposter syndrome can really be a total jerk. You start wondering, am I good enough for this? Is this, you know, something that I can actually pull off? Do I have the time and the energy to? Can I do a good job? And luckily, I was there at the con with some really good friends. And, you know, so when I talked to them and when I laid out the, like, so here's the offer, here's who's making the offer, and here's what the job is going to be. This would be a side job in addition to my full-time job. You know, have any of you worked with them? Do you have any advice? And my friend Isabel, who knew Lynn and Michael really well, just looked at me and she's like, what are you waiting for? Say yes. She's like, are you kidding? This is the chance of a lifetime. They're amazing, and everything that they do is great, and you know that because you've seen their work. This is exactly the sort of thing that you can do that is going to take the work that you're already doing with panels and your community organizing and make and bring it to a different level. She's like, you have to say yes. So I owe Isabel all the drinks forever for giving me that push. Because that's what happened. I mean, Lynn and Michael took a chance in reaching out to somebody who was not really a part of fandom. I wasn't a name. People didn't really know who I was outside of my local community. And it has been a hell of a ride for 2 years. I mean, I've loved everything that we've done with the magazine. I have actually been introduced to so many writers who I had not even known of until we got into until I started working for Uncanny, because what the magazine is doing is focusing on what is the best that sci-fi can give us, what are the wide range of perspectives and voices that are in science fiction and fantasy, what are those ideas, how can we test those limits, and with an awareness that there are voices that have been marginalized and ignored. I mean, Uncanny has been fantastic. Just, I didn't know that there was a huge Filipino area of fandom. And we've published some really great Filipino writers who submitted to Uncanny poetry science fiction fantasy stories. Isabel Yap, I had not read any of her work until I saw her stuff come through to Uncanny, and I know that whenever I see her name in a publication now, I want to pick it up and read it immediately. Alyssa Wong's stuff, M. Serino, who has had some amazing poems in the magazine. This has just been fantastic, and it's what happens when people who have the ability to open the gates of science fiction and fantasy, who have that power and position to bring people in, actually make the effort to not just open the door, but to actively invite people in and make them feel welcome and share their contributions and give them a platform.
Yeah, and Uncanny's been one of the places where I can consistently find stuff that is, you know, it's excellent. It's not just the same, like, five white dudes and two white women that are always, like, thrown out there for sci-fi names. I'm just like, oh, hey, it's a story of people who might look like me. Amazing. Here, take all my money.
It's great because I feel like every time if somebody asks me why they're interested in, like, why they should be interested in science fiction and fantasy, or what does the genre really look like, I'd be like, pick up an issue of Uncanny. Go through our backlog. You will find something that you like because it's, you know, there's a little bit of hard sci-fi here. There's some epic fantasy there. There's some speculative fiction. I'm not quite sure where the boundary of genre is, but if you like that sort of experimental bending stuff, you can find that in the magazine as well. And I like that we're going the whole spectrum from fiction to nonfiction. There are great interviews that Deb Stanish does with some of the authors who are published in the magazine. I've rediscovered that I actually like poetry because of the stuff that we have in Uncanny and the cover arts. I mean, like, I'm just going to have a wall in the apartment that is just dedicated to Uncanny cover art. I want all of them in giant poster size. They're fantastic.
I want the cover to 10. It's just bright and cheerful.
Yeah, I think that's Galen Dara's cover. I've actually talked to my tattoo artist. I am planning on getting the Space Unicorn tattoo from issue 10 as a sleeve on my left arm at some point. Maybe next year, maybe in 2 years. It depends.
That'll be really cool.
That'll be amazing. Yeah,
I still have to heal from the last tattoo that I got, which was the final color session was last Thursday, and it's... Oh, lower back is a terrible region to do, just so you know. It's every time I lean back in my chair, I remember that it's there right now.
I know that feel, because that's where my third and last tattoo I got is at.
So, oh, in your lower back?
Yep.
Oh, God. I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's been many moons, but that was not a pleasant night when I got home from the tattoo shop. But you know, yeah. we've talked a lot about Uncanny, and I think it launched today, the day we're recording, is the Year 3 Kickstarter.
Yep, yes it is.
And, you know, I kind of snuck and checked while you were talking, and it's almost at $7,000 in one day.
Yeah, that is, oh wow, I'm looking at the Kickstarter page right now, we are at 192 backers, because if we get over 200 before the end of the day, every backer for Uncanny's Year 3 Kickstarter will get an ebook of the Best of Uncanny 2015. Which, you know, there's some really fantastic stuff in there. It's a selection of some of our most popular short fiction and essays and poetry. And the cover that we selected was from issue 4, which was by Tran Nguyen, which is, that cover has actually been nominated for a couple of awards as well. I want to figure out how to cosplay the woman on that cover. I'd have to walk around with a stuffed leopard because, you know, an actual big cat would probably be a little hazardous to everybody's health.
Yeah, just a bit.
Yes. I mean, it would look really cool, but we'll just have to go with the little stuffed animal version.
Aw, but it would be adorable, though.
Yeah, I'm thrilled because the number of contributors that we have this year, like, I put together a collage of all of the contributors that we have for Uncanny, and if you look at it, it's like, I don't even need to say the word diverse because it's not something that, it is an ideal that is already baked into the magazine. It's baked into how we approach, you know, the stories that we select, because really when you are open to all sorts of perspectives and all sorts of ideas, and you go into it with an awareness that you are you know, you want to be aware that you are looking for voices who, you know, who may not have been, yeah, necessarily paid attention to before, like, you can get this really amazing collection of people and work together. Like, in the same, you know, we're going to have everyone from Paul Cornell to, you know, N.K. Jemisin. I've got Mary Robinette Cole and Sam Miller and Alyssa Wong and Ursula Vernon. And I'm so amazingly thrilled. We have Nalo Hopkinson is going to give us a story for year 3. And then nonfiction, because I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, we have an essay from Sophie Aldred, who played Ace, the companion, who was one of my favorite companions ever from Doctor Who. Like, that just is all sorts of squee fangirl sound making on my end. We have confirmed covers that we will get from Galen Dara again and Julie Dillon. And Grace P. Fong, if we reach, if we reach a certain level, Grace will be giving us full page illustrations to go with an original short story by Alyssa Wong. So help us fund that level, people. We need this stuff. It's going to be amazing.
So other than like all the amazing stuff you talked about, what else do you want to throw out to entice people to back the Kickstarter?
Well, we have some really cool sustainer levels. We have a couple of pick a brain levels where you can pick one of the volunteered contributors, and they will join Lynn and Michael for a hangout or a hangout on Google, or they will write a blog post on a topic of your choice. That is something that will be a lot of fun. Someone's already taken Nalo's spicy papaya hot sauce backer reward level.
Wow.
I was actually looking at that one myself. We have a Pick a Brain Live podcast edition. And if you, on multiple levels, if you back, there are, if you just pledge $10 or more, you can get an ebook copy of issues 13 and 14. Your name will be listed in issue 13 under acknowledgements, and you will get a copy of last year's issues 10 and 11 as well. The main thing, if you pledge for 25 or more, you get a a full subscription to Uncanny Year 3 in ebook format of your choice. So we have Mobi, PDF, and EPUB, and a couple of other really cool goodies. So if you take a look at backer rewards, we have a lot of stuff that we feel that can probably appeal to a bunch of different people. And if somebody wants to be super, super, super generous, at $5,000, we will be able to throw an Uncanny Con. The backer will get to be one of the guests of honor at Uncanny Con with other science fiction and fantasy professionals for a single day convention held at DeKalb. I have been told that there will be space for fire spinning for that. So if we are able to have someone backs us for fire spinning, there will be an Uncanny Con and you can be a guest of honor. You can be a very special space unicorn for the day.
Wow. Oh, hey, I'm a $200 pledge. I am. I'm part of the $200 tier.
That's right. You did volunteer for that.
I was reading and I was like, oh, wait, I did volunteer for that.
Yes, so someone needs to choose that so you can pick Tanya's brain.
And trust me, that is a bargain. I usually charge way more money for such things.
Yeah, so lots of awesome stuff here. And really, like, the thing is, you're contributing to a community you're becoming part of a really fantastic community of people who love science fiction and fantasy, who are excited to support new voices alongside familiar ones, and I think it's really helping build the type of community that we want in fandom. It's open to so many people, and it's inviting, and it's a place that I want to be in. So
yes, so support Uncanny, because I love it and I have no shame, and be like, support a real cool mag. So,
well, I mean, if we support Uncanny, a part of the whole deal is that if this is our budget for the year, this means that we get to pay our writers upon acceptance, not publication. As soon as we accept the piece, they get paid for it. And we pay 8 cents per word, which is that's more than the minimum pay rate, which is usually six cents per word. And if we reach our very first milestone goal, that means we'll be able to open for submissions, and we want submissions. So help get us the quicker we get to that first goal, we will be able to open, and then our intrepid Uncanny readers will have submissions to read again. They need work. We need to give them more fiction. Help us get to that very first goal as quick as possible.
All right. So when you hit that goal, in case someone listening is thinking about submitting something, when you are open for pitches, what sort of topics would you be looking for?
So when we open for submissions, we're open for poetry and fiction submissions. The guidelines are on the website, so you can go and see what we're looking for in terms of word count and how our submissions process works. We don't usually take pitches for nonfiction. Those are usually by commission. But when we're looking for fiction, the best thing I can say for fiction poetry, the best thing I can say is read the magazine, read stories that we have already published. All of our back issues, all of the material that we previously published is available to read for free on Uncanny's website. So if you want to see what the editors like, the best thing you can do is go and read and see what sort of things we've already accepted. That way you can see whether or not your writing style or the type of thing that you're working on would be a good fit for the magazine. I think that's good advice and this is advice that I've heard editors give time and time again, is that if you want to submit to a magazine, you've got a short story or a poem that you have worked on, go and read what the magazine you want to submit to has published. That way you can get a good feel for the taste of the editors, because a lot of it does just come down to what the editors like. And if you feel that you have something that would fit with other things that you've seen already published in the magazine, then definitely give it a shot.
Yay.
Like, I would assume that everyone gives that advice. I don't think many people follow it, though.
Well, it's also when a magazine tends to publish a wide range of things, the best thing is, like, you never know unless you're going to take a chance. So I am always of the, I'm of the opinion that it is better to submit and, you know, even if you get rejected, because that way you know for sure. Otherwise, you'll be sitting there and wondering, well, I wonder if they might have taken it, but I was, you know, but I'm not at, there's no sure thing. The only way you're going to know is if you take that chance.
It's absolutely true. From just like my experience, whenever a publication isn't like specific to a certain sort of genre or something, there is always something that is just harder to define that they're looking for. So looking through what they've put out is probably the only way to figure that out. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think, like, you just need to reading the things that, you know, the places that you want to be published in. That is the best possible thing that you can do. And also, you know, reading is one of the best things that you can do. Also learn what works and maybe what doesn't. If there is an author that is doing a particular type of narrative structure or a voice or characterization that you really like and you want to understand what they're doing, read their work. Actually read it with an eye to picking apart what they're doing so you can understand how they're building the whole story. There's a difference between reading for enjoyment and then going back and reading and trying to be like, okay, so I know the story is going from point A to point B. How does it get there? Why is it working? You know, how are flashbacks used? How are, you know, all of these different sort of literary techniques? And I've just by reading a wide range of fiction, even stuff that I don't necessarily like, I'm still learning, because maybe there's a technique or a way of addressing a particular narrative that I hadn't thought of before, and somebody else is doing it and they're doing it well. So that's what I want to learn from.
Very true. So I want to shift a little bit away from, you know, from talking about uncanny and writing. So, I mean, one of the things that we both have talked about, though, is, you know, being a person of color and being asked to do free emotional labor. Mm. And you know, sometimes it's from clueless allies. They don't mean harm, but they still do it. And then there are the people who come along with straw man in hand, burning as they run down the street. It's true. There's a reason I used the image I did in the Let's Talk About What Diversity Is and Is Not. I got those from you. And it's like, you know, red flag, straw man on the field. But, you know, I know how I deal with this bullshit. How do you deal with the disingenuous bullshit when that happens?
You know, I mean, like, it sounds like a flippant answer, but honestly, fire spinning has been really, really good for me in being able to, I like to deal with things by physically burning off energy. Going to the gym is actually really good for me. If I'm doing fire, particularly there are people that I can work with where I have swords, so, and they're built for contact, so I can actually do a little bit of sparring. There's something about that sort of physical confrontation within a safe space with people that you trust that is a good way for burning off a lot of that frustrated energy. Also, it's just having a group of friends who I absolutely, absolutely trust, who I can go to and just tell, and first, you know, always ask, be like, hey, I'm really dealing with this thing and I'm super frustrated right now. Do you have the time and energy for me to just sort of talk to you about it? And I'm not asking for solutions. I just need to vent about it to somebody who will understand. And that's for someone like me who grew up being very closed and feeling like I had to deal with everything on my own, otherwise, clearly, I was not a strong person, because a strong person wouldn't let this bother them and wouldn't need to unload on other people and all sorts of really harmful bullshit. Having people that I can trust enough to be emotionally vulnerable with, who I know aren't going to try to fix it for me, or try to tell me that I'm overreacting, or that somehow my reactions are invalid, that's so incredibly helpful. to have, because there is no way that I'm not going to run into things like people who are meaning well but still stepping on my feet all over the place, or people who are, you know, are waving a poor disintegrating straw man in front of me, and, you know, there's an army of disintegrated straw men behind them. Those people are always going to be there, so knowing that I have a support system in place that can help give me space to vent and rebuild myself back up, or even if it's a Twitter or a Facebook or even in-person conversation, if I can go and tag somebody in to sort of go and be like, they're not listening to me, you're white and you get it, can you please at least, maybe they'll actually listen to you, because I can't do this anymore. Having those people I know who I can tap in for those conversations, who will get it, makes it easy, you know, maybe not, I don't know if easier to deal with is the right way to put it, but it makes me feel less beaten down and frustrated and like I am wasting my time.
I know how that feels.
Also, wine and chocolate. Really? wine and chocolate and steak. Those are my go-to things.
That's a solid plan. I firmly approve of such things.
So, I mean, we're in the Midwest. You go for steak. If I was on either coast, I'd probably go for seafood. But since, you know, we're in Chicago, steak.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Anyway, all right, I'm back now.
It's Monday. that's what it is. It's Monday.
I'll take any reason. I'll take it.
You talk a lot about representation, online, on panels, the conversation. The conversation seems to go in like a circular pattern sometimes. Do you think that it's moving forward, that things will change, and do you have any light? When do you think that might be?
I wish I had psychic powers in order to be able to say when it would change, but I think the conversations are shifting in an overall positive direction, but it's not a linear path. There's a lot of step forward, fall back, move to the side, do the cha-cha. there's no straight linear forward progression. And I think that's what's so frustrating, is because for every conversation, for every really good panel experience I've had where I felt like the panel hasn't just retread old issues, but has actually managed to move the conversation forward. We've had, you know, there were good questions from the audience and a lot of good follow-up afterward. There are those discussions that just make me want to tear my hair out and pull a Liz Lemon ultimate eye roll, because it just keeps going, you know, going back and forth and back and forth. What I see is, you know, I partially curated a lot of my social media so that what I'm, you know, what I see is tends to be somewhat skewed in terms of people who are more likely than not to get it, to understand that it's okay to make mistakes as long as you are not doubling down on them and to sit back and listen. So I can see more positive growth, with the people that I know, but in the wider world, it is unfortunately not a straightforward pathway. There are going to be a lot of very painful, scrapes and bruises and falling down on our faces that is going to happen. And I feel like it almost has to happen because so much of the discussion has been predicated on coddling the feelings of particular groups of people in power. And when you have gotten used to being coddled, you don't realize that's what's happening. So when people are actually talking to you hard, real truth, you know, we all have fragile egos. I really don't think anybody actually wants to know that they're you know, that they're hurting other people. But I think the vast majority of us want to do, like, don't want to be that person who is being thoughtless, but we don't like to know when we're being thoughtless either, because then it destroys this whole picture that we have of ourselves. So it's going to be a lot of really hard, not only external, but internal conversations that we're going to have about these sort of things. But if I didn't believe it was changing, I would probably pack up and move to the top of a mountain with my husband and two cats and see you later.
Okay, then.
See. No, not the top of a mountain. I'm sorry. It's too damn cold. I'd find an island.
I was going to say, like, really? You know there's snow on top of most mountains.
I know. I just know. I need to find a tropical island. Not the island from Lost. A nice no. one.
No one wants the island from Lost.
No.
No, just send me to Oahu. Just send me to Oahu. I'll be a happy girl.
See, that being in Hawaii actually was a really interesting experience, because after having, you know, I haven't been to the Philippines since I was 12 and I'm 38 now. But when I went to Hawaii, that was about 5 or 6 years ago. And it was so interesting, where I looked like the majority of the people there. Like, between the purple hair, and at the time I only had one back tattoo, there were people who were just stopping me and asking me for directions because they just assumed I was a local.
Wow.
It's like, it was super interesting, different experience from being, like, in the mainland, in the middle of the Midwest.
Yeah, Midwest living when you're brown is interesting.
Well, you know, Chicago actually has one of the largest Filipino populations in the country, too. Like, this is consistently one of the few big urban cities that I've been to where people will consistently peg me correctly as Filipino.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Didn't happen in Boston. Happens in Chicago.
I've been to Boston. I'm not surprised.
I used to live with this Filipino girl in Texas, and everyone just assumed she was Mexican, and she just let it get to the point where she spoke Spanish.
I still speak French. I still speak a smattering of terrible broken French, but my accent is pretty good. So if I want to mess with somebody and they're like, "Oh, you speak really good English," I might jabber at them in French just a little bit.
That's impressive. But then what do you do if they actually speak French?
Then I'll be like, "Aw, sorry, man. I guess that backfired on me."
Whoops. But, you know, since we're talking about, like, fitting in and representation, I've heard you talk about this, but, you know, for the benefit of our listeners, what would better representation look like for you specifically in an ideal world?
I want there to be enough representation so that when we see, you know, when we see Black characters, when we see trans characters, when we see characters who are part of traditionally socially marginalized communities, that they are not bearing the weight of all those expectations for what those characters are supposed to do in a narrative, and for being shoehorned into tropes, or even if it's not being shoehorned into a trope where it's actually a good part of it's part of a character arc and character development. Even like I've talked about this with some friends who love Person of Interest. Some of the characters where we love their characters, and the way that they ended within the story worked for them, but because of the overall zeitgeist, it's still fitting into really sad, harmful tropes about what you can expect to happen to a character who fits into those marginalized identities. I want there to be so much representation that we are not, that those of us who are marginalized are not bearing the weight of all of those expectations and having to break out of those stereotyped roles. Because that's the benefit of being in that's the benefit of being the default, of being in the majority, is that you get to be an individual character. Your story gets to be an individual story without necessarily reflecting back on other people who are like you. And that is not a luxury that everybody gets, and it is a luxury that we all should have.
Very, very true.
A fun question to end this segment with, we suppose. You've mentioned that you're like a food geek on Twitter, and you actually, I think you talked about comfort food a little bit earlier, but we just wanted to ask, what foods do you like geek out about, and what is your favorite comfort food? Was it the steak?
You know what? Actually, I go back and forth because I am super picky about my steak. I like a good filet mignon. It has to be medium rare, that perfect sear and crust on the outside, but not overdone on the inside. But for comfort food, I love things like fried chicken, chicken fingers, French fries, mashed potatoes, mac and cheese. Those are the things that, you know, if I'm having a really, really crappy day, I'll be like, I just want cheese fries and a milkshake. But the foods that I love geeking out about, I really love, I love being able to fuse different types of foods and flavors. I've actually been spending a lot of time rediscovering Filipino food, because my mom used to make it. That wasn't all that she made, but a lot of it, you know, evokes these very strong memories of my parents. I mean, both my parents died when I was young. My mom had multiple sclerosis, and she was diagnosed when I was 3, and she died before I turned 12. And my dad was 21 years older than her and died of a stroke 2 years later. So food with both of my parents was a huge deal. It was part of how they built community. You knew that they liked somebody if they made food for them. You knew that they really liked somebody when they allowed them to cook in their kitchen and that they would actually spend time experimenting with and trading ingredients. So I've been liking to take a lot of Filipino flavors that I remember and seeing how I can mix that with sort of like the Midwestern comfort food that I remember growing up with. The other day, I actually went to the farmer's market and got some ground beef and potatoes and carrots and kale, and I threw it all in the crock pot with, I browned the meat and then threw everything in the crock pot with flavors that are normally part of adobo, which is a very, very standard Filipino dish that's usually made with chicken and pork. It's soy sauce, cane sugar vinegar, bay leaf, peppercorn, lots of garlic. I like throwing some chili peppers, some dried chili pepper, chili flake in there as well because I like my food spicy. And it was sort of a like ground beef stew chili mishmash that was just, it turned out really well. The flavors were soaked up by the potato, the way that red meat interacts with soy sauce and vinegar is a little different from how chicken and pork would absorb the flavor. So I'm still playing around with the exact quantities that I want to spice things up, but it's a lot of fun to do things like that. Like taking ube, which is another very ubiquitous Filipino ingredient in a lot of desserts. It is a sweet purple yam that I can't, like, Tanya, you've had my cookies. I mean, it sort of tastes like buttery, and it tastes like those Danish butter cookies that's the closest comparison that I can get to the flavor, but it's this actual gorgeous pale to bright purple color that when I show it to people, they're like, they ask me if that's actually food coloring. I'm like, no, that's actually the natural color of the ube when you're using the extract or if you're using it fresh. I have taken ube extract and I like mixing it with things like cheesecake, which has turned out really well. You know, you can pair that with a ginger snap crust, or taking ube extract and mixing it into snickerdoodle cookie dough and making snickerdoodle cookies because the flavor of ube turns out it goes really well with cinnamon. Like, I kind of want to see what happens if I replace the cinnamon with cardamom in the sugar that you roll snickerdoodles in. Getting to experiment and having friends who are willing to be my culinary guinea pigs when I try something like this is a lot of fun. And it's a way for me to express how I enjoy somebody's company. When I feed them, it says that I've invited them into my home, that I want to make them comfortable. Good food and good drink, I think, are some of the best social lubricants out there. If we had more, more meetings of heads of state and people over a good meal, I feel like we'd actually have a much easier time talking to each other, because good food puts you in a good mood and it makes you more willing to, you've already connected with somebody because you have shared food together. It's one of these very basic human interactions, and being able to share food with other people is a really easy way for me to sort of touch on what it means to be Filipino American. So there are a lot of ways, like food is a language, and some of my favorite stories use food. John Chu had a story in Uncanny Issue 4 where it's a hard sci-fi story in outer space, but there's still bits where the character is talking about the rich broth that his mother used to make that he has squirreled away on the ship, frozen for like when a point when he really, really, really is desperately lonely for home, and it's such a wonderful, wonderful thing. So food is one of my passions because I don't get paid for it.
Look, I was about to take those cookies and run, and I don't run.
I will. So if I make them with cardamom next time, you're willing to be my guinea pig?
Yes, I will be there like in 10 minutes. When you say you are baking, I will be there quickly.
Excellent.
Yes. So aside from like food geekery and me keeping you up late with great conversation, what's next for you, Mitchie?
What's next is, I want to make it through this week because we have the Full Moon Fire Jam on Wednesday, which is the monthly event that I'm one of the organizers for. We have a free community gathering on the north side of Chicago at the lakefront, where we have now grown to something like 50 or 60 fire performers who come in through the course of the night, who have all been trained in safety, who are responsible members of the community, and we will set up a performance area on the park, like on the grass, and there will be drummers providing music, because hippies and drummers. But it's a really nice community event where families and friends can come out. You can bring a picnic. We just ask that, because it is a Leave No Trace event, that people take their trash with them when they go, help us clean up the park. So that's a big event, because we usually get upwards of 800 to 1,000 spectators in the course of a night. Then Racks Geek is Friday and Saturday. I'm super excited about this because I have a Wonder Woman cosplay that I'm going to be wearing and spinning fire as Wonder Woman. That makes me so, so excited. Being able to do a matinee show for the kids, I am going to do something from Frozen for that with fire, because I like the irony of spinning with fire instead of ice. Also, it's actually more practical. I can't actually spin with ice inside the stage. And after making it past this week, getting past the Kickstarter and just keep plugging away. The last two Kickstarters, we hit all of our stretch goals, so I am hopeful that we'll be able to do the same thing this year and still keep up with production, because we still have the last issue of year two, the September-October issue for Uncanny, that needs to be done, so that is still in progress and in production. And making it to my very first Worldcon as a nominee this year, which will be August 18th through the 20th. So I just want to make it, I can't really think past mid-August because it just seems like everything is narrowing down on that. After all of these things are over, I need to take a break. I will probably take a couple of personal days from work, get reacquainted with my couch and my Netflix queue, and get caught up on the massive amounts of reading that I need to do, and at some point start working on a couple of short story ideas that I've had bouncing around in my head for a while. So I know that I should just sit on the couch and watch TV, but I have creative things that I need to do as well. So taking time to actually take a breath and restructure and make sure that I am making space for myself and for self-care, because Tanya, you know this, because this is why we are friends. Running ourselves into the ground is not a good idea. I need to be better and more proactive at making sure that I'm giving myself space to breathe and recuperate, because I am not 25 anymore. And it wasn't healthy when I was doing this at 25 anyway. Pushing myself to the point of collapse is not healthy, and it is not a good habit to be in.
Oh, I know that. I know that very well, unfortunately. I was just talking about that today with somebody else. Yeah. And oddly enough, even without a day job, I still am running myself ragged. So, yeah, I know that feel, unfortunately, very well.
Yeah, I think we need to make it. I think we need to take the time to make a trip to King's Spa for the day.
We do. For those of you listening, are like, what is King's Spa? It's an amazing, amazing spa where you can stay there like all day, right?
Yep. It's pretty much like all day. There are different sauna rooms with varying levels of heat. There is one that is hot enough that they cook eggs in it. I haven't managed to last more than a couple of minutes in that one before I stumble out in a giant pot, you know, as a giant walking pile of sweat. There are dry areas, and then there's the wet area for, you know, different levels of hot tubs, and you can get body scrubs, and it's a Korean style spa that is out in the suburbs of Chicago, so it's a little hard to get to. You usually have to plan, especially for those of us who don't have a car, but it's really good for just kind of going for the day and resetting yourself. And it, you know, if you do the body scrub, literally sloughing off a layer of yourself and just coming out refreshed and relaxed. Also, yeah. There's a Groupon right now for that, Tanya. So if you want to snag that Groupon, I think it's good for the next 3 months.
So when we're done recording, I may have to wander over to Groupon.
Yeah, because the other option is we go in a car, and you can tell I've done this a lot. You go in a car, you go to the Super H Mart, which is next door first. You buy a bunch of groceries, and you have a cooler with you, so that way you can put things that need to keep refrigerated while they're in your car. They'll be in the cooler. They'll be fine. Because if you buy over, I think, $20 worth of groceries, you can get a discounted day pass for King's Spa right next door. So you can do a double hit, get a bunch of awesome groceries at H Mart, which has Asian pastries, and that's where I go for a lot of my things like ube extract. They make fresh tofu in-house. That's really good. I can get things like maitake mushrooms and fresh vegetables that are a little harder for me to find or overpriced at places like Whole Paycheck, and then go spend the day at the spa, go home, and not only am I relaxed, I have a bunch of food for treats later.
Yeah, that store's dangerous.
Yep. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I usually come back with at least half a dozen boxes of Pocky Sticks.
And the problem with that would be what?
No. Well, the problem with that would be, like, they're half a dozen boxes of Pocky Sticks. They're not exactly the best thing for you.
I'm still failing to see the issue here.
Mm.
And on that note...
Pocky Sticks.
Yes, that can be our new cuss word.
So you're just going to leave everybody out with Pocky Sticks.
No, I've come up with some better swears. I kind of scandalized someone today with something I actually said.
Oh, God.
I'll tell you if you want to know.
Yes, I want to know. You don't set me up like that and then leave me hanging.
Oh, come on. You know it's good for suspense. If we had a commercial break, it would go right there. So I got groceries today, and being the smart person that I am, didn't close the freezer door before I stood up.
Oh, no.
And I started yelling about son of an Antivan whore. Now, unless you're a Dragon Age fan, that will make zero sense to you.
I've hung it up with enough people who play Dragon Age that I get the basic gist of this.
And I repeated this to people that I was watching a Twitch stream, and it was just like this dot, dot, dot. Why did you try to summon Zevran? And you know, like, once I made sure I was okay, but I was just like, of all the things that I could have shouted, that's what came out of my mouth. So I can come up with some, you know, creative swears if you give me enough time and pop culture references.
See, now I think we just need to make that a backer reward, or like you should do that for Patreon. Like, hey, back us for this much, and I will create a unique swear just for you.
Oh my god, that could be part of the package. Call Lynn and Michael right now. Like, what were you doing? But we actually do have quite a few listener questions.
Okay,
that we probably should get to at some point. This is the problem. When Mitch and I get together and start talking, this is what happens, listeners. This is sitting around at someone's place.
It's like 3 hours later. I'm like, oh, what do you know? It's dinner time. Let's go get food.
Right. And then you're like, oh, then it's time for drinks. I guess we're doing that now. David, do you want to take our first question?
Sure. Absolutely. So, yeah, our first listener question is from Sharif Jackson. And he asks, Asian American issues tend to be downplayed in the national conversation. What can we do as allies to help give these issues the attention they need?
A lot of it, I think, is just signal boosting is one thing. You know, if we're talking about, there's a push and pull between wanting to signal boost and then wanting to say something, but not wanting to overspeak the people who you're actually trying to help. So I think one of the easiest things that you can do is signal boost the people having these conversations. If they're, you know, if you hear things in your own circle of friends, your own circle of professional contacts, if people are saying things that are microaggressive, they don't have to be outright, like, you know, blatantly racist. Things like microaggressions and unquestioned stereotypes kind of call attention to that. You know, it's Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, we have a different road to hoe because we are also dealing with issues like the model minority myth, where, you know, it's the idea that, no, we're quiet and we can fit in, and as long as we don't make waves, and that just doesn't work at all. It is, you know, spending time listening to Asian American and Pacific Islanders when they're talking about things that affect them. You know, please just squelch on that very understandable defensive urge to say yes, but, or well, actually. Just, you don't actually have to get involved in the conversation. You can take a seat and listen and consider and sort of try to internalize what is being said, reevaluate how you might have looked at things before, and integrate these new pieces of information and new perspectives, and you might realize that you are now seeing things that maybe you had missed before. Just pay attention to the media that you're consuming and understand and seeing how Asian Americans, how Pacific Islanders are being positioned as characters. What are the differences between those of us who are of the diaspora versus, you know, first generation immigrants or source landers? You know, people, the perspective that someone who is Filipino and who has grown up in the Philippines is going to be very different from my perspective, because I was born and raised here in the States, specifically in the Midwest, in Chicago. So understand that we are all not a monolith, that we can, you know, we can speak to the commonalities of our experiences, but we are also not, we're not to be your, well, I have this one Asian friend. Asia is a continent, not a country. And please do not use us as your shields to justify your racism towards other people of color. I cannot stress that enough. Please, please, please don't do that, because I see that happen so often where someone will be talking about issues affecting Latinos or issues affecting Black people, and then someone will always bring up the, well, my one Asian friend doesn't think that. It doesn't matter. Don't use us that way. Please stop. That's one of my biggest pleas. Just please stop using us that way.
Definitely. And I want to throw in, don't be that person that's like, but I saw this thing, and aren't you mad about it, and aren't you going to yell about it? Because if you are talking about something as a Filipino woman, it is not my place. Even though we're both women of color, your perspective and mine are not the same.
Right. I mean, there are commonalities of experiences that we have as women of color, but they are, that doesn't mean that it's the same thing.
Right. You know, and for me, that's aimed more at, you know, well, I'm going to give benefit of the doubt, well-meaning white friends who think that they're being useful, and actually they're not. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a whole other, that can be a whole episode by itself. But our next question kind of touches on things that you mentioned in answering Sharif, from Garrick Hosh, who is an awesome listener and sent us a question for you. And he asks, as a Filipina, how do you navigate geek spaces where discussions and examples of quote-unquote Asian representation usually assume people of Japanese, Han, Chinese, or Korean ancestry, while Filipinos specifically do not seem to feature prominently either in media or discussions of Asian representation?
That is a really good one. Usually what I personally try to do is, I mean, I can talk about what it's like being Asian American, being Pacific Islander, in America, because again, there are a lot of commonalities that, you know, Asian Americans, regardless of ethnicity, do share. But what I'll usually try to do when we talk about representation, and we're talking, you know, someone will bring up there a lot, you know, whether it's a Japanese character or the use of, maybe like Chinese stories. I will just mention that, yes, well, you know, there are those, but also there are, you know, you need to remember that Asia, again, continent, not country, and that there are a plurality of ethnicities who identify as Asian, Pacific Islander, and that we all have very distinct cultures. We have different traditions, different stories, and there are different stereotypes that tend to be appended to us. We're not all the same, and it is, you know, one of the things that I have tried to do, I used to just say I'm Asian American, which is true, but because there is a lack of representation for Filipinos within this whole greater identity, I try to at least, you know, make sure that I'm noting that I am not only Asian American, I am Filipina. That is the heritage that I come from, that informs a lot of my identity and how I tend to view things and what I'm looking for in media. Because, you know, I've seen a lot of the Asian characters who were in media that I liked to watch, you know, I related a lot to Claudia Kishi from The Babysitter's Club when I was growing up, because she was the only Asian character who was part of the main cast, but she's Japanese, she's not Filipino. But because there was nobody else, that's who I was glomming onto, and also, you know, she was a really cool character. So it's also just kind of, I just at least try to make sure that I'm making that distinction where I'm not erasing my identity as Filipina when we're talking about issues that affect most Asian Americans, because we can talk in generalities, but when we start drilling down into the specifics, I cannot speak for somebody who is Japanese. I cannot speak for somebody who is not Filipino. Nor should anybody expect me to.
True. I'm gonna let David take the next two questions from our friend Matt, because I know
Matt.
I hit the microphone.
See what you did, Matt? You fucked it all up. I got to your question, and you fucked it all up remotely. But I just want to sit back and see what happens, because we know Matt well, and I want to see what happens.
Okay.
All right. So Matt's first question is what Star Wars character and or storyline would make for an incredible video game?
Yeah, and Matt knows that I don't play video games, but Matt also knows that I have feelings about Star Wars. So since the news broke very recently that Grand Admiral Thrawn is back and is now going to be made part of the actual Star Wars canon, I want my Mara Jade character in starring in her own video game that is now part of the new Star Wars canon. I have loved her character since they brought her in, Timothy Zahn brought her in the first trilogy that he wrote. I identified with that really, really heavily when I found those books. They came out, I was barely a teenager. And particularly now that we have a character like Rey, and, you know, we've got Finn, who is, you know, he's definitely going to be doing some really cool stuff, and he's coming from an outside of, he's not a Jedi, but he was part of the stand-in for, you know, the new version of the Empire. I feel like having them in a game with Mara Jade would be absolutely incredible, because here's someone who is skilled in the Force, who was part of the original Empire but became disillusioned with it and had her own level of growth and independence. I didn't read a lot of the books that came after, so I'm just going to go with the version that I know of Mara Jade from the original trilogy, because she is awesome. And that's what I would love to see in a Star Wars video game. Give us Mara Jade. You gave us Grand Admiral Thrawn. You brought him back. You can bring back Mara Jade.
All right, then. Did you hear that?
I told you, I have feelings.
I don't want to get lost in Star Wars.
Yep.
It's too easy for that to happen. When it comes to fire spinning, what is left on your bucket list?
Ooh.
What would be? Oh, there's another sentence. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
It's okay. What would be a high spot in your career?
So I'm really excited that I'm going to be doing Wonder Woman. That is one that I've wanted to do for quite some time. I will be using fire poi and short fire swords for that one. But I still want to do a multi-person choreographed fire piece to the theme from Pacific Rim. That is such an amazing piece of music, and I feel like it's long enough, and there's enough beats in it that I think it would actually work really well choreographed with several people actually taking part. And it's such a killer piece of music. The one that I really, really want to do that I kind of feel like would be the apotheosis of nerdery for me is my favorite movie. My absolute hands-down favorite movie, regardless of genre, is Conan the Barbarian, the original one with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's best because he barely has any lines in it. It had the first action fantasy female character who I absolutely adored, Valeria, the warrior thief, who was just, in that movie, she was absolutely amazing. And the music by Basil Poledouris, and I'm a huge soundtrack nerd, film scores and stuff like that. Basil Poledouris' theme for Conan that opens the movie is just powerful, and it has a lot of emotion, and just, it has that adventure theme to it. And I would love to be able to do that piece, use that piece of music, be dressed like Valeria from her final scenes in the movie, and have and perform using a pair of full-sized fire swords. So that's what I'm working toward doing at some point. I just need to find a good venue for it, because the one that we're currently performing in right now, I can't use big fire tools because the ceiling, there's not enough space to do full-size bokens that have been wrapped in Kevlar and are shooting flames up fairly high. I'm only 5 feet, but I'm still performing in heels, and that gives me a couple of extra inches, and that's just, there's not enough safe clearance for that, for doing something like that.
No, don't burn down the theater. That would be bad.
No, but Conan, Tanya.
I know.
Spinning fire to Conan. You have no idea how much I wanted to do this.
Oh, I'm sure. Just don't burn down the theater.
Nah.
So our last few questions before we wrap up talking about what we've been playing, reading, and watching is from our usual buddy, Tim, also known as Thane1982 on Twitter. He asks, first off, if the MCU ever actually decides to give us Miles Morales, who would your ideal fan cast be?
You know, if it had been a couple of years ago, I would have said Glover from Community, because I just feel like he would have been a really, really, really good Miles Morales. But honestly, my ideal fan cast, I want to see somebody new. This is sort of how I feel about a lot of particularly superhero roles, and especially if they are marginalized characters. I want to see them given to new faces, people who we haven't really seen on the big screen before, because I feel like it brings something fresh, and it's giving an actor a chance to grow into that role. I mean, we look at... Daisy Ridley for Star Wars. Rey is her breakout role. I have not, like, she wasn't really seen in much before that, and that has given her a huge platform to jump off of. And I feel like roles like Miles Morales, or getting to see Kamala Khan, all those characters, those roles would be doorways for new actors to make their way into the business and be able to point to, well, yeah, look what I did with this character with this giant blockbuster franchise. That opens up a wealth of opportunities, and I think it should go to people who really haven't seen before.
True. I mean, I can't think of anyone unknown, but I'm sure there has to be someone out there, because, you know, at this point, I think Damian Glover also maybe...
Yeah.
Like, Miles Morales and Damian Glover don't quite go together in my head right now.
I think it's because he was so adamant about wanting to play the character before. I think that's why I identified him as someone who I'd want to see. And I haven't read as much of the character as I'd like to. But yeah.
So Tim's other question was, what kind of venue do you like best for fire spinning? Because you talked about your current venue not being what you want to do for, like, your ideal performance. So what venue do you like best?
I actually like doing it outdoors, because there is, if you're doing it outdoors, you have the best possible ventilation. Because it doesn't matter what you do. I mean, you're still, like, we use white gas, which gives off the least amount of smoke when you are working with fire. But there's still it's still going to get a little smoky, even when you're in the venue that we're in right now has pretty decent ventilation. It sort of limits the number of fire pieces that we can do, because we don't want the venue to get smoky, and we usually go straight through for an entire hour. We don't have an intermission. One of the things I like the best about the Full Moon Jam is that we are outside. We have a performance area that we rope off that is big enough that we have about 6 or 7 fire performers in the circle with enough space for everybody to be performing at the same time. There's space for them, and each person has a safety spotter. So technically there are about 14 people in the circle at a time, because when at a Full Moon Jam, after you're done fire spinning, you take over for your safety spotter, and then you spot the next person who comes up and takes your spot. So I really like I would like something that combines the space and of being outdoors with having some of the conveniences that you have from being in an indoor space, like having an audio setup, being able to have something that is like a stage. But there's something that feels very special to me about spinning fire outside under an open sky with stars and the moon and the city lights as your background.
Yeah, because one of the best pictures I've seen of you fire spinning is that outdoor photo of you that I think is still your Twitter handle, Twitter icon?
It might be actually, the Twitter icon is, that was actually Matt. What he did was he took a photo from our last Rax Geek photo shoot where I'm dressed in my Imperator Fieriosa Mad Max outfit, and I've got fire fans, and the photographer managed to catch them at this really awesome moment where they're posed and the wind was coming by, so the flames look really active. And then Matt basically took that and made it into a cover of The Uncanny X-Men, except he titled it The Uncanny Mitchie, but it looks like the X-Men comic book title. I adore Matt just for making that for me. That's like, that brought, you know, like, I started reading the X-Men when I was when I was 14. And that is, you know, teenager me's dream of like, I am on the cover of a comic book and I'm a fire spinning mutant. That is, yeah. I really, really, really love that picture. But, and that was taken outdoors. There's an underpass on the north side, like super far up north. I think it's like getting close to Evanston. It's an underpass for the L, where when you walk through the underpass, there's a massive collage of a galaxy, and it's gorgeous. So we managed to do our photo shoot there, and the pictures were incredible. It was also incredibly cold on that day. It was incredibly cold and windy, but the photos were totally worth it.
Well, you were spinning fire, so you were a little
yes.
warm.
Yes. Well, when I'm moving, yes, but when you're standing around and waiting because you're with five other people who also need their photos taken, it was a cold day, but the photographer was Braden Neeson, and he's taken photos for Rax Geek for us before. And he just, at this point, he really knows how to capture some of these amazing, amazing shots. Like catching fire in a photograph is kind of hard, particularly when it's windy. So I'm very thankful for the type of job he was able to do for us.
It is an amazing shot. And then, you know, the last question that Tim had that we touched on a little bit, mm-hmm. but his last question was, what has been the best part of being an editor for Uncanny?
Being able to be part of a community that is supportive of the type of science fiction and fantasy that makes me feel at home, that makes me feel like I am actually a part of the genre, I am part of the community. And that's been the best part of it, is being part of Uncanny and part of building this publication that makes people excited to be a part of science fiction and fantasy, that makes them proud and happy. That is the best possible reward or gift we could ask for actually, you know, for making Uncanny every issue. It makes so many people happy, and it makes them proud to be readers of science fiction fantasy and proud to be fans. So as long as we can keep doing that job, that is going to always be my favorite part of being, you know, being Uncanny's managing editor.
Mm-hmm. That is really cool.
We're sadly at the last portion of the show, because I don't want to stop talking to you, but I also get I can also just call you and talk to you, so.
Yeah, I still need to go actually record the Kickstarter ad for Uncanny's podcast tonight, too. So,
oh, wow. So we'll be quick.
Yeah, that's great. It's all fine. I'm just not going to get sleep this week. That's just the way it's going to be.
again.
Yeah.
So what we usually wind up the show with is talking about what we've been playing for the most part, or, you know, for a guest is not so much a gamer, we talk about what we've been reading or watching. And since you are our esteemed guest, you get to go first. What have you been doing in your limited free time?
Actually, for playing, it's not a video game, but I had a friend, my friend Gordon introduced me to this game called Super Fight. It's a card game that kind of works on the Cards Against Humanity's model, where you've got two decks. You start out with two decks. One of them is a deck of characters or character types, and then the other deck is superpowers. So you basically, you know, you have someone you'll pull out. So I've got a unicorn that can shoot rainbow lasers out of its ass versus a superhero who is actually a swarm of bees. Who would win in this super fight? And that's how you determine who gets the most cards and wins. It has a bunch of expansion decks. There's a specific expansion deck for the offensive cards, so those aren't in the original deck. If you want it to be that kind of game, then you have to buy that expansion deck. I really like the fact that that's already been, like, taken out, so you don't have to include it in the game if you don't want to. There are other expansion decks where you can have a location card, so you've got, you know, you've got your two superheroes, your two characters with their specific superpowers. Who would win this time in, let's say on an alien planet with no gravity? So there are different decks that you can use to switch up those variables. There's one that's specifically that has fairy tale tropes, fairy tale trope cards. There's another one that is like super kid friendly type things. I really like the game and how many different permutations there are of it. I've played it a couple of times. The Chicago Public Library had a deck, so I'm actually thinking about getting my own. I've also been enjoying Marrying Mr. Darcy. It's another card game. That's super fun. Reading, I started reading Sarah Kuhn's Heroine Complex, which I've been really looking forward to. It is a story about Asian American women who are best friends, one of whom is a superhero, and the other one is her best friend, who's basically like her personal assistant. And the story is what happens when the personal assistant actually has superpowers, and the two of them have to reevaluate their working relationship, how their friendship works. There are demon-possessed cupcakes within the first couple of chapters. It is all sorts of ridiculousness, and I love it. I'm really enjoying it so far. I just finished watching Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, and I have complex feels about that series. But the thing that I really, really love about it is I want everything in Miss Fisher's wardrobe. That TV series is like 20s era fashion eye candy. It is amazing just watching all the things that the characters are wearing. I think I'm going to go, I'm not sure what I'm going to watch next because there's still a lot of, I still haven't caught up on all of the last season of Arrow or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and I really should. Before the fall season comes around, because that's going to be here faster than I think. Actually, one thing I'm really enjoying watching, speaking of Lost, is this comedy on, I think it's on TBS. It's called Wrecked. It's a half hour comedy and it is totally tearing the shit out of Lost. It's the same premise. You've got a plane full of people, complete strangers, who have passed, who crashed on a tropical island somewhere, but it's taking all of the things that Lost did and just making it super funny. Okay, it's ridiculous. And I think my husband Jesse and I enjoy it so much because we watched Lost, we stuck with it to the bitter end, and I do mean bitter. So watching a show that is tearing all of those tropes to pieces that Lost was playing with and just ripping the crap out of it. Really enjoying it a lot.
I'll have to find that and watch it because it sounds hilarious. Because I, too, stay till the bitter end of Lost. And I'm still mad about it to this day.
Bitter, Tanya. So bitter.
Very bitter.
I feel vindicated in never watching the last season. I sort of went into it going, they're going to fuck this up.
Purgatory. Just, if the last season had just been the island and none of that sideways purgatory flash shit, Lost would not have ended on a terrible note. But that ending to me was everything about, well, you've just completely ruined any of the emotional stakes that we've had with all of these characters and watching people die because, oh, look, they're actually all together in the afterlife anyway, blah, blah. Like, I'm probably going to end up writing out a rant comparing the ending of Lost to the ending of Person of Interest. Because Person of Interest had that door that they could have walked through where they had that same kind of ending, and they didn't take that out. They actually took the harder out. So that may have to be something that I write about. Or rant. More likely rant, just because I have lots of feelings.
Well, when you write that rant, please share it with us.
Definitely will.
David, what have you been up to?
I've been checking out the update to Fallout Shelter, which is Fallout-y. And, you know, Pokemon Go, like every other human under 30 in America. But actually, and I didn't write this down, I recently watched the last two episodes of Star Wars Rebels, because I'm also on that cartoon podcast. And that's the show that replaced the Clone Wars. And that is actually, the trailer for season 3 has Grand Admiral Thrawn in it. It's gonna be interesting. But, I feel like, one thing I just want to say about it, based on the conversation leading up to this point, is that, it sort of feels like they're rewriting the story of Kyle Katarn from the Dark Forces series, and it's better the second time around.
Really? Huh.
And a lot of people die for a cartoon.
I could, you know, we grew up with cartoons where people died, so...
Yeah. Robotech, I think, is still a scarring experience for a lot of people, because when Roy Fokker died, we're like, wait, what?
And Optimus Prime in the original Transformers movie.
Oh my god, yeah. My poor kid brother. We saw that movie in the theater. There were tears. There were so many tears. I took my husband to see it as an adult after we'd, like, you know, we'd started dating, and he had never seen Transformers the animated movie before, and it was playing as a midnight show, so we went to the theater. So, you know, remember what the first 15 minutes are like. You know, they're killing off all these main characters that we had seen in the cartoon, like, left and right. So he turns to me, he's like, did you take me to a snuff film of my childhood? What the hell is going on?
Oh,
I'm like,
God.
Oh, no.
Oh,
also, like, as a Star Wars fan, I find it fascinating because it's the only thing that really, in the new, like, Disney canon, it's the only, like, ongoing thing they're doing in the, you know, Imperial era, the original trilogy era. Mm. And it's interesting to see which elements of the old expanded universe get brought back in, because this cartoon counts, according to Disney.
Huh. Oh, wow. Snuff.
Like, they brought back Inquisitors, the Imperial Inquisitors, and a few other things.
Huh. See, now I want to watch the Transformers movie, but I don't want to, like, make myself cry before bed.
Well, it's got Weird Al Yankovic singing the song that is played during the chase sequence on the junk planet. So that might make up for the tears.
That's true.
I will share this. I'll share it with you later, but I actually have video of me spinning fire to You Have the Touch.
Wow.
Yeah. And you knew who the nerds were in the audience when the song got going and they were like, oh, that's what that was.
We know our people. We know our people.
Yes.
And then this is probably the only time that David and I have been playing almost exactly the same
it's
thing.
It's true.
It's a little uncanny.
Womp womp.
Damn it. I leveled in dad joke. I wasn't even trying, actually. But yeah, I've been playing Pokemon Go when I can actually get on the server. And Fallout Shelter, because it came out for PC. And I won't use all my data trying to play
about
it.
The PC thing, yeah.
Yeah, so like with the phone version, I turned my back for like 2 minutes and suddenly babies. And I'm like, what the fuck? I literally turned my back away from the tab where it was open for like 2 minutes.
I should definitely check out the PC version. I didn't really worry about data because it doesn't really communicate with a server very much.
I just didn't know if it was pinging back to anything, so.
Not like Pokemon Go, which is constantly.
Yeah, I'm not even thinking about that right now, because I'm going to cry if I think about how much data I probably used in 4 days. But yeah, and of course, always Inquisition, because that is my comfort food game to go back to. Because I've modded my game, my PC game, to the point where I'm just like, you know what? I'm just enjoying it. I'm going to play out scenarios and not really worry about the actual plot of the game at this point. But yeah, this is a first for us, where David and I are playing the same things. And with that, we are really for real at the end of the episode. So Michi, one, thank you so much for spending so much of your evening with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me on. I always love having conversations with good friends, and I appreciate the chance to be able to talk about a lot of the things that I'm doing and just to be able to geek out with good people.
Yay. Well, you know, you can always come back and geek out with us.
Yay. I will totally take you up on that.
Awesome. So for those folks who have listened to the episode and want to learn more about you, where can they find you online?
You can find me on Twitter as Geek Melange. That is also the name of my blog, so that would be at geekmelange.com. I'm on Facebook. I have the follow option turned on, so you can follow me on Facebook. You can also follow Uncanny at Uncanny Magazine on Twitter. We also have a Tumblr. The website is uncannymagazine.com. All of the links to the Kickstarter is on there, but if you look for us directly on Kickstarter right now, it is Uncanny Magazine, Year 3, The Space Unicorn Flies Again, is the name of our campaign. And actually, you can also follow me on Instagram. On Instagram, I tend to post a lot of selfies and pictures of food and shiny things and nerdy things. That's generally what you'll be able to find. Chicago Nerds is also online at Chicago Nerds on Twitter and ChicagoNerds.com. We also have a Facebook group that you can ask to join. We moderate, as Tanya knows, because she is one of our fellow moderators, the group is moderated according to our community guidelines. We expect people to be respectful and to have a good time, but we do not put up with any shenanigans in our group, and I'm very proud of that. And you can also follow Rax Geek at Rax Geek on Twitter. And also RaxGeek.com is our website. You can find background on all of our performers and when we have shows, generally in Chicago, although some of the troop members will be performing at Gen Con next month as well. I unfortunately will not be because it is too close to WorldCon, so I will not be able to attend. But you can definitely catch the rest of the Rax Geek troupe, and they will be performing with the Acrobatica Nerd Circus. So Nerd Circus performers, contortionists and jugglers, and I think there are a couple people who do aerial performances in nerdy cosplay as well. So definitely check them out.
Yay. David, where can people find you?
I can most easily be found on Twitter at Red Conversation. I can also be found on Gosh Cartoons with Kiva Bay and Virender, who is sadly in the news again. As well as davidlreeves.com. I've been working as a freelance editor for the past 5 years, so if you need one of those, I'll look at whatever you send me. and probably regret saying that.
And you have a Patreon too, right?
This is true. I actually do. I have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/redconversation. And I put up the first three chapters of a, I'm going to call it pre-cyberpunk novel I wrote a significant portion of while I was depressed to see what people think. But you have to give me like a dollar to see it. So it's got all sorts of things going on in it. I don't really know how to, it takes place in an arcology built on top of a sinking New Orleans. And it's in this like sort of, yeah, I'm going to go with it's arcology detectives from like multiple agencies conflicting.
Cool. And you all can get that for just a dollar. I'd say that a story like that is a buy for a dollar.
And I'll probably, if there's like a positive response, I'll probably keep sharing the drafts there until it's done.
And then you'll go shop it around.
Yeah, that would be the logical conclusion in the best case scenario, yeah.
Woot. And as for me, I'm Cypher of Tyr pretty much everywhere. On Twitch, Twitter, my own site, and Patreon. Or you can also find me under I Need Diverse Games. And with that, this episode is a wrap. I don't want to stop talking to such wonderful people, but it's almost 10:30 at night in Chicagoland, and I'm sure David would like to also go have dinner. So with that, we're wrapping up this episode, and next week we're actually going to have the creator of Easy Level Life and also Resync the Game with co-host JP Fairfield of Nerdgasm Noir and Operation Cubicle, and that will be episode 59, so we'll see you in a week. Thank you and good night. Thank you.